You work and work for years and years. You're always on the go. You never take a minute off, too busy making dough. Someday you say you'll have your fun when you're a millionaire. Imagine all the fun you'll have in your old rocking chair.
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
What I have to tell is a very grim story indeed.
But it does require that we have a moratorium on any new coal-fired power plants. And over the next 25 to 30 years, we're going to have to phase out those that exist.
What if you knew that every time you flip on your light switch, a mountaintop in West Virginia just blows up?
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Alex is about to die. And enter the year 2009.
Is it already too late to stop rampant climate change? An emailed blog posting asks, do we just enjoy the time we have left? Scientist James Lovelock thinks so. He wanted the subtitle of his new book, Vanishing Gaia, changed from Final Warning to Enjoy It While You Can. He tells famous interviewer David Frost in April 2009.
Enjoy it while you can.
Enjoy it while you can. And how old are you now?
I'll be 90 in July.
That's the opening for my Radio EcoShock show for June 26, 2009. We'll hear more clips and quotes from that program later on. We'll also talk with Ipek Genchku about the macro picture as billions of humans move into the cities in the next 50 years. Will they find a climate-friendly infrastructure to support them or carbon-intensive slums with no services? But first, we'll be joined by a medical doctor who asks a simple question. Should we wear clothes that endanger the lives of the people who make them? Watch out for viscose, whether it's rayon, cellophane, or the common dish sponge. The chemicals used to make them may have driven workers crazy. It's just another journey into the underworld of the toxic society. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Now and then, just one dedicated person can put the spotlight on a dangerous chemical. Every day, some of us wear or use products made with this toxic process. Few people know fabrics like rayon are made from forests boiled down by dangerous chemicals. So are cellophane and dish sponges. That person could be Dr. Paul David Blank. He's a real doctor and a professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. The story and the warning come in Paul's new book, Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here.
What put a practically unknown chemical like carbon disulfide in your sights?
Well, I'm an occupational medicine physician by training and also a medical toxicologist. So in that narrow field, people have heard of carbon disulfide, partly because it's such a powerful and fascinating toxic substance.
What is it really? I mean, is it a dust or a powder or what?
No, it's a liquid. It's a solvent. It's a very elegant little molecule, just one carbon and two sulfur elements linked together, and doesn't occur very much in nature except in the mouths of volcanoes and certain other rarefied situations. So essentially a synthetic chemical, but it has a long history. It goes back to the 18th century.
Well, let's talk about the fake silk in your book title. What is rayon and what makes it distinct from other industrial fibers we've heard about, like nylon or polyester?
Well, first of all, it's the granddaddy of all these fibers. It really predates all of the petroleum-based synthetics including nylon, which came onto the scene in the late 1930s. But rayon was invented at the turn of the last century, just before 1900. And unlike the petroleum-based products, it's based on cellulose from plants, mostly wood pulp. That's all fine and good, but the key ingredient in making all that happen is this chemical called carbon disulfide.
I know that a lot of high-fashion designers, names we'd all know, use rayon. Paul Blank, what do they like about it, and why do consumers like it?
Well, consumers like rayon because it has silk-like properties, if it's pure, and also because it can be mixed with a lot of other fibers and give interesting blends. There's not a hazard to consumers by wearing it, so there's no risk there, and that's one of the reasons why people have not paid much attention to what happened to the workers who have made it for the last 120 years. In terms of fashion designers, it's people love to play around with new stuff. And there have been times also where shortages of other materials or political considerations promoted the use of rayon. So during the German occupation of France, when the Germans were quite interested in promoting the rayon industry, there was quite a push for French high design to use lots of rayon and rayon blends.
Well, let's talk about the known health impacts of carbon disulfide as used in the production of rayon and cellophane and other industrial products. Why don't we begin with the brain effects? I'm not really talking about mental health here, but just what does it actually do to the brain?
Well, the mechanism of its toxicity is still a matter of research debate. It's actually hard to tease out the mental health effects from other effects on the brain because, in fact, the mental derangement that it causes is one of its most stunning effects. And probably it interferes with various metabolic pathways and is able to cause these problems through that mechanism. So it was first noted very early on after it was first introduced industrially, not in rayon because rayon didn't exist, but in the rubber industry where it was used as part of an alternative vulcanization process, that the workers would go insane. And in fact, one of the rubber factories was famous for having iron bars on its second floor windows because so many workers had a tendency to jump out and kill themselves. Also was quite recognized to cause sexual proclivity in those exposed. That was later followed by impotence. So it had sort of a two-phase response.
What about heart problems? Is that why so many rayon workers died young?
Later on, and by later on, I mean it wasn't really until the 1960s that it became appreciated that long-time lower-level exposure, long-term lower-level exposure to carbon disulfide could, in fact, cause premature heart attack and premature stroke. That was difficult to study because it required some of the modern epidemiologic techniques that only came into the fore in the decades following World War II.
And as a sidelight, I found an astounding note in your book that the workers' compensation system in the United States doesn't seem to be actually written to protect the workers. It seems to protect the employers. No matter how egregious the damage or the death, the worker can't sue the employer. Why not?
Well, that's just standard in workers' compensation law. You cannot sue your employer. You're confined to stick to the compensation monetary scheme that's written into the law in the various states. If you're a consumer and made ill by a product and or what's called a third-party relationship, then it's possible to sue, but not as an direct employee. So, in fact, for the asbestos industry, their Achilles heel has not been people who actually worked for the asbestos mining and milling companies. It was for secondary users who bought asbestos from a primary source.
Donald Trump has highlighted the flight of manufacturing jobs away from America and towards other countries in Mexico and Asia. Where were the major rayon factories of America and Europe located, and why do you think they closed down one after another?
First of all, they were the first to flee to other sites. So we're talking about the 1960s and 70s, but they were originally located in Pennsylvania and then fled to the southern United States where there was less unionization of the workers. And that's been a classic in the textile industry generally. So later on, they were more concentrated in Virginia and Tennessee, North Carolina, and Georgia. And then these were mostly part of multinational corporations, which is another classic manifestation of this industry. From even the years before World War I, they were cartels. And then between the wars, they were really interlocking directorates of various companies. The biggest American manufacturer was called American Viscose Corporation, which was wholly owned by the British. It wasn't a publicly owned company until 1941, when the U.S. forced them to sell publicly as a quid pro quo for lend-lease, which the Americans were not going to agree to. Courtauld, actually, their big cash cow was the U.S.-based operations that they had, although they had huge operations in Great Britain and the famous plant in Ontario that they had as well, which they were not forced to sell, obviously, because that was Canada. I don't think anybody wants to bring back these dangerous and polluting manufacturing sites to the United States, but there still are sites that manufacture with carbon disulfide. The largest cellophane factory in the world is in Kansas, and the various sponge manufacturing sites are in the United States as well as in Europe. There's also a very big industry of a sort of relative of cellophane, which is used to make skinless weenies and other rayon film packaged sausages. Then the rayon film is removed and you have a skinless sausage.
So what are the current allowable levels of carbon disulfide in the workplaces of the world, and are they good enough?
It depends on where you are. So the United States, the OSHA limit is about 20 times higher than what our own governmental scientists recommend is safe. So the value in the OSHA law is 20 parts per million. California, which can make its own stricter standards, at least right now it can, the limit is 1 part per million. And in fact, the U.S. limit is so lax, it's only met, I think, by the standard in India. Even China has a somewhat stricter standard. And China, India, and Indonesia are some of the biggest current manufacturers of rayon fiber.
Yeah, I think about half the rayon in the world comes from China now.
It may be close to that. Oh, fiber we're talking about, yes.
Yeah. You know, digging around, I was looking at the disposal of rayon, and it turns out to biodegrade better than cotton. But then Wikipedia pointed me to a paper published in 2014 saying, quote, "A recent ocean survey found that rayon contributed to 56.9% of the total fibers found in deep ocean areas, the rest being polyester, polyamides, acetate, and acrylic." So I'm wondering, how does so much rayon find its way into the ocean? Do you know?
I haven't a clue. I can say that the reason why it's biodegradable is it's regenerated cellulose. So the final product, the carbon disulfide, has all gone off into the air, often the air in which the workers are, but sometimes the ambient atmosphere. So that's why it's biodegradable, and that's why the rayon manufacturers and the viscose manufacturers market this material as being a green product, because it uses renewable cellulose rather than petroleum. It sort of ignores the carbon disulfide side of the equation, which is anything but a green product.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Paul David Blank. We're talking about the lethal history of viscose rayon. As you say in your book, Paul, Fake Silk, that there has been a TV expose on the mental health impacts on workers at the Chinese electronics makers like Foxconn, but the risks appear to be greater for rayon workers. Why do you think this toxic production scandal, I'd call it, has evaded public scrutiny for so long?
Well, it hasn't evaded public scrutiny, in fact, or medical knowledge. It's just that there's a cyclical amnesia, I would describe it as, for this industry. You know, when even in the 19th century, when it was used in the rubber industry, very quickly there was medical recognition within just a handful of years of the new technology. And there were exposés periodically in more popular media as well. So it's not really through lack of knowledge. It's through a disequilibrium of economics and power, I would say.
Is there a threat to people living around those industrial plants that use carbon disulfide?
Well, clearly there have been examples of release into the ambient atmosphere that's been substantive enough to be associated with suspect effects. The most famous case was actually in Alabama, where one of the last U.S.-based rayon factories was, and where local residents noted that their prized horses were dying off, and it was found at autopsy to be suspect carbon disulfide related. They sued the plant and lost on a small technicality of how the nuisance law was written or the timing of some other piece, but not on truly substantive grounds.
In your book, you describe the modern production facilities of the Lenzing Group in Austria, and the carbon disulfide is carefully enclosed and vented for worker protection, but vented to where, and can you somehow collect and store it, or what happens to it?
Well, they try to the extent that they can to recycle it into the process, right? I mean, the motivation for many of the controls has not been purely worker safety, but it's that it's cheaper in the long run if you don't send all this chemical up the smokestacks, because it leaves the product and you can reuse it.
So, Paul Blank, how does carbon disulfide reemerge from the pesticides story?
Well, it has a long history as a pesticide. It was the preferred, although useless, agent to try to stem the phylloxera epidemic of the 19th century that wiped out much of the grape industry in France, and they used many tons of this stuff. But it persisted as a fumigant in the grain industry until the 1970s, when the EPA in the United States finally nixed it. And it's still a byproduct of certain other pesticides. It was also like the preferred gopher exterminating agent, because it's heavier than air. It's very volatile. So you pour a bunch of it down a gopher hole and plug it up, and it kills all the gophers. So, in fact, there was a famous case report, not famous, but an impressive case report, let's say, in California in the late 19th century of two brothers who had 20 gallons of carbon disulfide that they were using to kill gophers, and it turned out there was a leak in the can, which they kept right near where they slept, and you know, they both went insane. One murdered somebody, and the other one just went crazy.
What's your impression of the health standards for carbon disulfide in China?
Well, on paper, they're better than the United States. What's actually going on in practice is almost anyone's guess. There are some very large foreign manufacturers there, but they have their own domestic companies as well.
And what other countries are currently manufacturing rayon?
Well, let's talk about who's manufacturing viscose. So viscose in general, as I said, there's big manufacturing of cellophane in the United States and elsewhere outside of Asia. The sausage casing business is huge in the United States, in Europe, in Mexico, I believe there's a big facility. And the sponge business is big everywhere. It's really just the textiles that have concentrated in the last few decades in China. India is huge, and probably their conditions are worse than China, would be my impression. There certainly has been almost no study there. And Indonesia, not known for its biomedical research or protection of anyone.
So is there a way around this? Is there a totally safe way to make rayon or cellophane?
Well, first of all, there are some non-carbon disulfide processes. One of the newer ones that's been introduced that's actually a viscose process uses a different chemical, but it really has very little human testing data on or animal testing data. So it's hard to know what the risk-benefit ratio might be, although it is, I grant you, it's hard to imagine a chemical worse than carbon disulfide. And then there are non-viscose rayon-producing methods. In the beginning of the introduction of these first synthetics, in fact, viscose was just one of several, but most of the other ones have died out. The one that hasn't is something called cupramonium production of rayon, which is a kind of niche specialty fake silk that is the preferred lining of bespoke suits, for example. If you buy a really high-end Italian designer suit, it's probably got a viscose lining, which is cupramonium, or sometimes referred to as Bemberg silk, because the Bemberg company in Germany used to be the big producers of this. Now it's produced in Japan.
So how do you hope this book will be used? What's it going to do?
Well, I think it's a cautionary tale. So it gives people a sense of what questions they should be wondering about with any new technology. This, after all, was as highfalutin and new as anything else in its day. But in terms of the textile industry also, I think consumers have to ask themselves, is it okay if what I wear is completely safe, but somebody had to risk their life making it? This is not just limited to viscose. We've seen an epidemic of silicosis in young persons sandblasting jeans to get a distressed look. And it's really parallel to the issue of, is it okay to get that cheap T-shirt that somebody made in a 10th floor sweatshop in Bangladesh that was about to collapse on them or be burned to death in the tradition of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire?
We have to own our clothes then.
Yes, and I think there is some movement, consumer movement, to demand verification that the methods of production for what they buy are inspected and meet some kind of minimal international standards.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add, Paul?
Well, I think that it's just important to always remember that the tale that I tell is something that happened to real people. These were real lives that were damaged or lost, and we need to remember these people. It's important. Just even that act is important, to honor them.
I've just read the new book, Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. The author and our guest is M.D. Paul David Blank. Paul does clinical studies and research, plus he's the chair of occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. You can find links to this book and the basic deadly chemistry of boiling down wood in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Dr. Paul Blank, thank you for sharing your time and for this warning.
Oh, I'm very happy to have done it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
It'll soon be over for you. The rest of us, the walking wounded, must go on living for a while.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
You haven't heard?
Heard what?
The radio.
Do we still get to avoid more warming here?
There is nothing that we can do to stop a climate change in its tracks. There's a tremendous amount of momentum built into the climate system. We are not yet experiencing the full consequences of the heat-trapping gases we've already added to the atmosphere because of time lags in the way the global climate system responds. So we will see some continuing increase in global surface temperature and regional increases in surface temperatures no matter what we do. But we have a big opportunity to minimize the amount of change we will experience. The aim that most scientists who study this matter have agreed is one that is still within reach and is highly desirable, would be to stabilize the concentration of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere at a level that would limit the global average surface temperature increase to about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit above the pre-industrial level. Now, if we do everything right, I think we could achieve that.
Well, my view is our duty is to survive. You see, it's not going to be totally fatal. There'll be quite a lot of us survive. And our descendants have got to inherit a worthwhile place. Like these islands, for example, are going to be horribly overcrowded. So are lots of other places in the world. We don't want it to turn into some sort of shackville. We want it them to have sort of decent cities with proper infrastructures. And that's enough of a job to keep us busy. I don't think we should be wasting time and energy trying to stop it with rather useless means. They talk of a tipping point, that we go so far and then there's catastrophe. But it implies that you can go back if you don't reach the tipping point. I don't think we can.
That was Sir James Lovelock with interviewer David Frost on April 10th, 2009. Our next clip comes from a program called The Hour on CBC in Canada with host George Strombolopoulos.
Is it certain parts of the globe that are going to be harder hit than others?
Very much so, and Canada is unusually favoured. This is the sort of place, when it happened before, 55 million years ago, life not only survived, but things moved here to get away from the heat. Mm-hmm. And that's likely to happen again. But this time it'll be people moving. And I think the main problem for Canada will be how to handle the influx of people from outside the world and when to be able to say, no, we've got enough now. If we take any more, we can't feed you. The best way to look at it is, I think of yourself as somebody walking in a forest somewhere, and you pick up a gun, and you accidentally pull the trigger, and it goes off and does some damage. You didn't intend to do that. You kind of pulled the trigger by accident, and that's what we've done. We pulled a trigger on the system, and the system is now moving into another state.
So let's say, like, in centuries and centuries from now, this could have happened anyway, but we've just kick-started the process.
Exactly.
So that means, then, that we should have a really good time, shouldn't we?
Well, it won't be all bad. No. There'll be some exciting moments, I think.
That's another selection of Early Madness from my 2009 Radio EcoShock show, Enjoy Yourself, It's Later Than You Think. Of course, now 7 years after, it's even later than that.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. There are still the optimists who work to persuade world governments to start aiming for a sustainable world. Let's hear what they think. More than a few scientists on Radio EcoShock tell us our present economy threatens perhaps to kill us and take out many other species in the sixth great mass extinction. Surely, we all have an interest in a new climate economy. And that's a huge global task. I've come across a report that seems written to me in a bland code for top government and corporate planners, but there are gems buried in this work titled The Sustainable Infrastructure Imperative. It's the 2016 report from something called the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. Their website is newclimateeconomy.net. To help us sort out who that is and what this report can tell us, as citizens of this planet, I've called on Ipek Genshu. She's the research and engagement manager at the New Climate Economy. Ipek has degrees in politics and economy from the London School of Economics. You may also have heard about her as a campaigner for the charity Oxfam and for climate and food justice. From Washington, D.C., Ipek Genshu, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, it's great to be here.
To be honest, I'm a little afraid of this interview. Can we hope to translate this 2016 report into something that means something in the lives of our listeners?
I think we definitely can, because infrastructure is something that most of us live with every day, and I'm here to try to explain why I think it really touches all of us. It's important for all of us.
Okay, well, can you explain what the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate is and how it was formed?
Sure. So the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate was commissioned by seven countries in 2013. Those are UK, Norway, and Sweden, our three funding countries. And we also have Ethiopia, Korea, Indonesia, and Colombia, developing countries. And they got together and said, we need to do some really strong analysis to show whether we can have economic growth and reduce the effects of climate change at the same time. Now, there was a lot of worry at the time by countries implementing renewable systems who thought this is hurting our economy, it's too costly, and we just cannot do it because for the sake of our citizens, we have to prioritize a strong economy for them. So the Commission got together, and with the help of 8 research institutes, but also a number of international organizations, experts in this field, we put together analysis in our flagship report in 2014, which showed from across the world examples of how sustainable growth, low carbon growth, can be compatible with strong economic growth. And we followed up our work in the guidance of the Commission and an economic advisory panel over the past few years to dig a little bit more into detail in specific areas and also in different countries to show how this can be made possible.
And this report is about infrastructure. Can you give us examples of what that is?
Sure. As I mentioned, infrastructure is something we live with in our lives every day. It's the buildings that we live and we work in, our homes. It's the transport systems. It's the roads that we drive on and the train lines we take into work. It's also the source of our power. So the coal plants or solar panels, whatever source of power you use is what provides electricity for us and keeps us going. Our water systems, our sewage systems, that's all infrastructure. We look at infrastructure and we look at evidence across three sectors in our report. Those are cities, energy, and also land use. So we importantly say that land use is also a type of infrastructure. So irrigation systems, landscaping, all of these things are things that we impose on the existing landscape, and we see it as infrastructure.
How does the Global Commission define the difference between sustainable and unsustainable infrastructure?
So the definition isn't always very clear, but we go with three broad principles. One is that it has to be environmentally sustainable. So we are using the world's limited resources. We have to do it in a way that provides for future generations. The second component of environmental sustainability is, of course, climate change. So we have to make sure that we're limiting the effects of climate change by reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So sustainable infrastructure is also low carbon. The second component for us is it has to be economically sustainable. So it doesn't burden governments with debt for generations to come. And finally, it has to serve all. It has to be socially sustainable, not just the select few who can afford certain types of life, but it has to enable everybody access to work opportunities and to be connected to their families and live in healthy, happy environments.
This report contains a roadmap which identifies the need to stop subsidies of fossil fuels by taxpayers. Who are some of the countries who offer those subsidies, and how big is the total?
It's a lot of countries, a lot of developed countries, and also developing countries. Worldwide, there are about $500 billion of subsidies offered by governments to both the production and the consumption of subsidies. For example, Russia offers about $23 billion a year. In the U.S., the value is about $20 billion, actually just over $20 billion a year. This is federal subsidies as well as subsidies in fossil fuel producing states. And the difficult thing about subsidies is that they often benefit the middle class, because they're making it cheaper to drive cars, they're making it cheaper to use electricity, when a lot of the poorer segments of the population don't get most of the benefits. By comparison, quickly, to also put it in perspective, renewables only get around $120 billion per year as subsidies. So, there's a really a lot of money going into this to continue our high carbon-based way of development, and there are also good opportunities for reforming these subsidies, which has been happening in many countries, including in Indonesia, in Canada, and the U.S. and France as well. They are starting to restrict them, which is good.
Is the clean infrastructure we're looking for a responsibility that governments direct, or is the private sector involved?
It's obviously the public sector's responsibility, because they owe it to their citizens to grow the countries in a good way and providing services to people. But for the private sector, actually, it's a great opportunity. It's a great financial opportunity, because a lot of money goes into building the buildings and the transport systems, but then their use generates a lot of income for them. So it's an opportunity for both. In developed countries, about 60% of infrastructure is built using private funds. In developing countries, this is the other way around. So 60% comes from the government. We actually need to increase private financing towards infrastructure, because we'll be making around $90 trillion of infrastructure investment across the world over the next 15 years. And a lot of this money will have to come from private and institutional investors.
And the report calls us to transform the financial architecture. Can you give us specific examples of what is needed?
Sure. So this sounds a bit jargony, but the main point is our financial systems and processes are based on a previous model of development, which was quite short-termist. It was based on fossil fuels. It was based on building roads and getting people to drive cars. So all the risks and opportunities are around providing for those. What we now need to do is to make sure the financial system works for renewable technologies, for green investment, for sustainable investment needs. And so the difference will be that there are more upfront costs, but in the longer term, there'll be lower operating costs. So, for example, if we take the comparison of a coal plant versus solar panels, it is probably less costly to build a coal plant than the same amount of energy coming from solar panels. But once you build the coal plant, you have to keep supplying it with coal, whereas the sunshine is free. So the financial system has to take this into account and lower the risks of the upfront capital costs so that in the long run, the costs level out and investors are actually interested to invest in these technologies.
To hear the politicians talk, governments are investing heavily to help develop a survivable, low-carbon future. But we learned from this report that, quote, today's public research and development and deployment of energy as a share of GDP is half what it was in the 1980s, end quote. How is that possible, given the dangers we face from climate change and the challenges of feeding a growing population?
Yes, I mean, you're right that this figure is very worrying. We do have to invest more in sustainable technologies and research and development. I think part of the reason might be that there's a lot more private funding going into these areas, which is great. But we do need government funding to guide us in the right direction. Government funding is a big signal of the way things have to develop. And if they are signaling that these low-carbon technologies are a priority, that will also catalyze private funding towards them. The other thing that the governments need to help us fund is the deployment of existing technologies. We have a lot of technologies already available to us. The costs are coming down, and it's just a question of making sure that they get implemented in different businesses, in different areas, in schools, in buildings. A lot of these technologies, energy efficiency technologies, can be implemented, but we need to make sure that the government is supporting this.
Now, the 2016 report from the Global Commission begins by saying the existing stock and use of infrastructure is associated with more than 60% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. That's a shocking number, and where does that 60% number come from?
That comes from some analysis we did earlier on in our research in the first year, which basically says that all the processes that go into construction, into cement and steel production, and the emissions that come from their use, from power plants, from the use of motor cars, all of these add up to 60% of all our global emissions. So this is a very significant percentage. And of course, we have to keep building, but there are ways of getting this number down.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Ipek Genchsu, and we're talking about a new report from a global commission and the need for a new climate economy. The very first sentence of the executive summary raises questions for me. It says, quote, investing in sustainable infrastructure is key to tackling three simultaneous challenges, reigniting global growth, delivering on sustainable development goals, and reducing climate risk. Well, the last two are fine, but I realize the mantra for all politicians is growth, growth, growth. But our listeners question whether growth is possible in a world constrained by the limits of nature and the things we've been talking about, resources and atmosphere. So if we really want to save the species and the future climate, shouldn't we be talking about planned degrowth instead?
Well, in an ideal world, maybe you could say yes. But to be honest, this is not a realistic approach, I think. There are two issues with it. One is that it's not the way our world works. As you say, our politicians and high-level decision-makers, business leaders, have to look into a portfolio that is going somewhere, that is growing. So while I think there is a role for scientists and NGOs to keep pushing for minimizing this relentless growth, we do need a bit more of a realistic outlook on this. Secondly, we need to provide for the people in low-income countries and middle-income countries that still lack access to basic services and goods They need access to healthcare, transport, education, and clean and safe housing. So we do need to grow their economies and their infrastructure systems. It's just a question of balancing between what some of us in the developing world consume on a daily basis and what others have to. So I can give you an analogy. If you had a wardrobe full of clothes, as most of us do in some parts of the world, you don't need any more. In fact, you could be recycling some of them. You could be giving them away. You could definitely reduce your amount of consumption. And this is what a lot of approaches of resource efficiency, such as circular economy approaches, help us do. On the other hand, as I said, many people do need access to things. If they have a wardrobe with nothing in there, they do need to provide for themselves. So we will have growth, but hopefully it will be a changing way of growth.
Well, I know you worked on climate justice issues, IPEC, and what is at stake for the women of this world?
Well, this is a really crucial point, and I probably cannot do justice to it as part of this interview. There are so many interlinking advantages and disadvantages for women in this sphere. But in short, we could say that in developing countries, many of the burdens of lack of infrastructure and services fall on women. So they are the ones who spend a considerable part of their day fetching water, providing food for the family. They're the ones who are suffering from health risks, and they're the ones who have to give up their education as a first member of the family. So making sure that the sustainable infrastructure is something that governments can provide will free up their time and their resources and empower them to be able to access the workforce and hopefully reach a level of equality with other parts of the population.
I'd like to address a question that came up in a short online video about this report at New Climate Economy. And it says, in the next 15 or 20 years, we're going to build around 1.5 times the infrastructure that already exists today. That frightens me because we're going to impinge on the world even more than we already do. Who says that's going to happen and where is it going to happen?
Well, so this is on an analysis that one of our partners, Brookings Institution, conducted for us. And it shows that the amount of infrastructure in place is pretty much the same as the amount that is going to be built. Now, this is based on some calculations which are looking at population growth trends and urbanization trends. By 2050, for example, we expect 70% of the world's population to live in cities. At the moment, about 30 to 40% of them do so. So it's going to be a huge increase. In India, about 400 million people will move to cities in the next 15 to 20 years. In China, about 300. In Nigeria, about 200. You know, this is a huge influx of people from rural areas into cities, and they will be requiring the services, the infrastructure that, again, most of us enjoy in more developed countries. And we will have to build a large amount of infrastructure to be able to provide for them, which is why exactly this point about sustainability is key, because the way in which we make these infrastructure decisions in the next 3 to 5 years will determine the future of our planet for decades to come.
That is an awe-inspiring number of refugees. It's or mass migration, let's call it, not to mention the refugees that we're expecting. So it's a huge change in the world population and where they live. Now, the video is introduced by the former Mexican President Felipe Calderón. What is his role in the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate?
So President Calderón is our chair. He's the chair of the Global Commission, which is a body of about 24 people, former heads of government and business leaders. And he has been involved in this area since he hosted, as the president of Mexico, a key climate conference in Cancun in 2009, where he realized that this was increasingly an important topic for the world to get together and address. So he's been involved in leading the commission along with other partners and other, as I mentioned, business leaders and heads of development banks and others to try to determine the research that we do and our ability to influence high-level decision makers.
Right about now, there are big projects, proposals sitting on the desks of legislators, prime ministers, and presidents awaiting approval. Some are pipelines, some are green mass transit, and most of them will produce still more greenhouse gases through cement and transport and mining and all that. Couldn't we just stop building infrastructure and help save the climate that way?
Well, as I said before, we could do it, but it's unrealistic. And also, it's not morally right. You know, there are a lot of people in the world who deserve access to services and healthcare and education. And there are about 1.7 billion people who have no electricity access. Can you imagine your everyday life without electricity? There are about 3 billion people who don't have clean cooking facilities. They're having to do makeshift solutions. And so we cannot stop building infrastructure, but we can be clever about the way we build it. We build it in ways that are sustainable, that provide for those people, and we don't build unnecessary things. We don't consume in unnecessary ways. In the developing world, we build smarter transport systems where many people can share transport or they can use public transport and train lines instead of building roads, which encourage individualized car use.
The new Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, just announced the National Climate Plan will include a price on carbon. Is that happening in many countries yet, and why does it matter?
Yes, so it's quite encouraging that about 40 countries and 20 subnationals are introducing carbon pricing. And it's important because carbon pricing basically means taking into account what it costs to continue to fund fossil fuels and a high carbon-based development model. So if you price carbon, that is, first of all, sending a signal to people saying, you know, we think this is costly to our country, the way we develop, so we should limit it. It's a good tool to be able to make decisions and allocations. If you take into account a cost of carbon, you can say this project, this renewable project, is less costly because it doesn't emit carbon emissions. And finally, it can raise financing. At the moment, as we discussed, a lot of government subsidies are going towards fossil fuel projects. And if you were to decrease that amount, that money could be used for much more useful areas, such as providing services and education to people. And just to finish up on that point, it's not just governments. About 1,200 companies across the world have introduced or are planning to, in the next couple of years, an internal carbon price. That means they're making their company decisions, taking into account the cost of emissions, which is very encouraging.
We've heard some stories about developing countries skipping the stage of fossil fuel development, going straight for greener technology. Is that just hype or is it happening?
It is happening. One of our commissioning countries, Korea, for example, has been able to do that really well and providing, as I mentioned, these connected transport systems for people and efficient housing. So it is possible, and it's actually posing really good opportunities for us in the developing world and low-income countries. For example, in Africa, where people don't even have internet access or landlines, they're able to buy mobile phones, and through that, they're able to pay in installments for solar lighting systems. This is exactly what we call leapfrogging. It's, you know, skipping past some of the business's usual ways of development that the high-income countries have experienced. And instead, it's going straight through to cleaner, more sustainable ways, which are also better for countries' economies and for people's pockets.
Ipek Genshu, in addition to your qualifications in politics and economics, you have an activist background. Can you get some things done where you are now?
Yes. So I think activism is a very important part of this puzzle. And in fact, the important Paris Climate Agreement that was signed in December last year was the result of the collaboration between activists, NGOs, civil society, and businesses and government. So I think there's a really important role for all the different pieces of the puzzle to work together. In my role now, I'm much more working with decision makers in government, in ministries, and we really have to work around their constraints about, as we mentioned earlier, about economic growth and about having to meet financial targets. So I feel like in this role and as part of the new climate economy team, we're able to do that because we understand how they think, we understand the constraints they have, and we try to come up with solutions that work for them.
You know, after going through the 2016 report, I had the urge to rewrite the whole thing for the common person. We're the ones at the end of the new pipelines or switching on solar-powered lights instead. We buy the gas or electric-powered cars. Don't we need a vision of sustainable infrastructure that translates into the lives of voters, of the public?
Absolutely. Our mission in the New Climate Economy team is to influence high-level decision-makers, ministers and CEOs, etc. But there is a great need for the general public to make these arguments and, in fact, to switch their way of life. Especially those of us in richer countries, we do have to make sure we make our everyday decisions in a way that is sustainable. And this is now emerging, especially amongst the millennials and the younger generation, through car sharing systems. You know, not everyone believes that you need to have your own car anymore, because there are great apps that you can use on your mobile device which allow you to share with friends. There's a great recycling, circular economy practices where people are able to borrow from each other and recycle their furniture, their clothes, their books. These kind of things are already emerging, and we just need to keep doing it. We just need to encourage it, and we need to make it cool to live our lives in this way.
And at the end of the online video, Felipe Calderon says, it is time for us all to realize that sustainable infrastructure is not just one potential pathway among many, but the only growth path for our future. Could you tell us why this is true?
Well, one side of the story is the catastrophic predictions that some scientists are making. If we were to continue in the path that we're on and the world's temperature, average temperature, increased beyond 3, 4, 5 degrees. That would become a completely inhabitable world with much more extreme weather events, with floods and hurricanes that would destroy many, many parts of the world. So we definitely don't want to go down that path, and we definitely don't want to take that risk. But on the other hand, there are some more important things that we're experiencing now every day, such as high levels of air pollution. You know, using the model of growth that we've used with fossil fuels, with cars, we are emitting so much carbon dioxide in the air, as well as other harmful gases, that it's really damaging our lives, it's damaging our lungs and our health. So this is the only growth story for the future, because it's the only one that will limit the risks for the planet, that will limit the health risks for us, and finally provide a sustainable and inclusive way of growth for the developing countries and the developing population.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. We have been diving for diamonds in a very big picture report from the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. Our guide from the Commission is the activist and expert Ipek Genchsu. Thank you for your help, Ipek.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. You can find this new report at newclimateeconomy.net, and I'll put links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
Tom Petty speaks about the environment at rockearth.com.
I've always put a lot of stock in the human being, you know, maybe more than I should. But I put a lot of stock in humans. I know some humans that are pretty doggone great and pretty doggone powerful. So being a cautious optimist, I tend to trust that the humans will somehow save us from total annihilation. But as far as the environment goes, I don't know if it's getting better or worse, you know. And at least there's an awareness that it's a bad thing to tear it up, which we didn't have, you know, not so many years ago. But I think it's got a long way to go. I think we're just going to really have to count on people. And it's a corny thing to say today, and it's an almost laughable thought, because they've just torn hell out of everything they've ever got their hands on. But I think there's something in them that could also do something really great.
Well, I've worn back down. No, I've worn back down. You could stand me up at the gates of hell, but I've worn back down. I'm gonna stand my ground. I won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground. And I won't back down.
We'll head on out with more clips from my 2009 Radio EcoShock show. I'll put links to the whole program in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And please, don't forget, you can download all 10 years of Radio EcoShock shows for free. scan around, pick out the ones that look interesting, courtesy of Radio EcoShock listeners. There's a wealth of great science, authors, and activists just waiting with their voices still worth hearing. Feel free to load up your phone, iPad, or whatever with those MP3 files to listen and to learn. The world is changing so fast we all have to keep educating ourselves. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening and caring about your world. James Lovelock is 90, famous and wealthy and ready to push off. He can be optimistic about a giant cull of humanity, mass death within the lifetimes of our descendants or sooner. Oh, great. So let's just give up and enjoy ourselves with another cruise ship holiday? No, thanks. I've got a much better scientist role model for you and for me.
We did not realize until recently that previous warm periods, the previous so-called interglacial periods, some of which were warmer than the present one, were not very much warmer. At most, 1 degree warmer than the present period. On the other hand, there were times, if we go back 3 million years ago, when the Earth was about 3 degrees warmer, but it was a different planet. There was no sea ice in the Arctic, and sea level was at least 15 meters higher, probably about 25 meters higher. That's 80 feet. I mean, that's a huge climate change. It's something that we really would have a very hard time dealing with because we've set up all of our infrastructure with the coastlines where they are now. And also, a warming that large would have a huge impact on many species. It would drive many high-latitude and high-altitude species to extinction. So we really cannot afford, we really don't want to have a climate change of anything like that magnitude.
It's James Hansen, the head of NASA, Goddard Space Institute for Space Studies in New York City, and a professor at Columbia University. Way back in 1988, he warned the U.S. government that climate change could damage our world.
What did you say to the Congress 20 years ago, and how was it received?
Well, I said that 1988 was likely to be the warmest year in the history of instrumental measurements. And I said that the Earth had entered a period of long-term warming. I could say with 99% confidence that it would continue to get warmer, and that this was almost certainly due to human-made greenhouse gases, and that this affected the probability of extreme events like heat waves and droughts. And since then, the events have proven those statements to be basically correct.
That was James Hansen speaking with the unbeatable Diane Reams of NPR in a 20-year retrospective.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.